Hello, and welcome to the Mainstay Medical 2019 half-year results conference call. Throughout the call, all participants will be in a listen-only mode, and afterwards, there will be a question and answer session. Just to remind you, this conference call is being recorded. Today, I'm pleased to present Jason Hannon, CEO, and Matt Onidis, CFO. Before I hand over to Jason to begin today's call, please note that this call may contain forward-looking statements. In this regard, please refer to the note on forward-looking statements included in the company's 2019 half-year results announcement issued this morning, and to the statements regarding the company's principal risks and uncertainties contained in the company's public disclosures available on its website on www.mainstay-medical.com. Jason, please go ahead with your meeting.
Thanks, operator, and thanks everyone for joining us today to discuss our 2019 half-year financial results and a general company update. We look forward to providing details for you regarding our progress and our plans. A few highlights just to frame our call. First, we're pleased to announce that we submitted our pre-market approval application, or PMA, for REACTIVATE to the U.S. FDA in August as planned. Next, we continue to make progress working with key physician partners in Germany who are incorporating REACTIVATE into their practices in order to validate commercial adoption of REACTIVATE, refine patient selection strategies, and follow ongoing patient progress. With a very small team, we are nonetheless on track with our goals of attracting new implanting physicians to REACTIVATE. From a finance perspective, in July, we completed the last steps of our financing plan, which provided approximately $28 million of cash runway to support our clinical, regulatory, and commercial objectives. This financing is designed to fund the company through and beyond the expected FDA timeline and enable us to build further commercial validation in Europe. I'll now cover our key regulatory, clinical, and commercial developments in more detail, followed by a brief review by Matt of our half-year financial results and financing efforts, and then I'll open up the call for questions. Let me begin by discussing the PMA for REACTIVATE. As I mentioned, we submitted the PMA in August. Assuming acceptance of the submission by the FDA in October, after its limited administrative review that's ongoing right now, a decision on approval is expected around the end of 2020. We remain optimistic regarding the chances for approval of the PMA based on the unmet need for these patients and the totality of our clinical data, which we believe provides solid clinical evidence of the efficacy and safety of REACTIVATE. As a reminder, the pivotal clinical trial upon which the PMA submission was based is the REACTIVATE-B clinical study. Indicative of the unmet need in this patient population, the patients in this study had an average duration of chronic low back pain of 14 years. These patients have tried many other treatment alternatives without success and have to resort to coping strategies and pain medications. Importantly, 79% of the patients were on pain medication at baseline, and 37% were on opioids at that time. Now I want to help you understand the source of our optimism for approval. While the responder rate on the primary endpoint at 120 days was 57% in the treatment group compared to 47% in the control group, which was less than statistical significance, a plethora of other critical data points demonstrate the effectiveness and safety of REACTIVATE in this patient population, and these will form the core of our PMA. First, regarding the primary endpoint data, we conducted two analyses which were each pre-specified in the protocol. Using the exact same data as the primary endpoint, but looking at cumulative proportion of responders, we achieved statistical significance. A cumulative proportion of responder analysis measures the number of patients that reported each given amount of pain relief from 0% to 100%, rather than simply looking at how many were above or below just 30%. This is a comparison of ranks, which naturally provides much greater information than a dichotomized endpoint, and therefore has greater statistical power. In that analysis, a P value of less than 0.05 is achieved, with the treatment group showing a higher proportion of responders across all threshold levels. The other pre-specified analysis focused on the monitoring of the subject's medications, which is crucial since any increase in medications would automatically deem a patient to be a non-responder under our study protocol. Focus in this analysis was placed on patients that increased their pain medications for reasons other than low back pain and the impact of those increases on the 120-day responder endpoint. There were 6 patients in the study who increased their pain medications before the primary endpoint visit for reasons unrelated to low back pain. These reasons included a broken ankle, tooth extraction, anal abscess, etc., all clearly unrelated to back pain. We conducted the analysis by removing these patients from the data set, since use of these medications for reasons unrelated to low back pain was an exclusion criteria in the study. Importantly, the decision to remove these patients for this analysis was made months before the data was revealed. When these 6 patients are removed from the data set, the responder rate at 120 days in the treatment group is 61% compared to a responder rate in the control group of 47%. The difference based on this analysis is also statistically significant. In addition to these 2 pre-specified analyses of the responder rates at 120 days, we observed statistically significant differences between the treatment and control groups on several key secondary endpoints and supplemental analyses. These include mean or average reduction in VAS pain, patient-reported percent of pain relief, improvement in disability as measured by the Oswestry Disability Index, or ODI, change from baseline in quality of life measured by the EQ5D metric, the patient's own global impression of change, patient treatment satisfaction, and clinician global impression of change, all of those endpoints. All of these metrics showed statistically significant differences between the treatment and control groups, and all of them at 120 days. This is with a therapy that is restorative by design and takes time to have a therapeutic effect. Many people have asked, if REACTIVATE is restorative by design and takes time to be effective, then why was the primary endpoint set at 120 days and not much later, like 6 months or even a year? The answer to this is highly practical and one that will be a large focus of our ongoing discussions with FDA. First, half of patients were asked to endure a surgical implant of a sham device and not receive the intended therapy during the sham period. Ethically, this can only go on for so long. Second, as mentioned already, patients are required to hold all pain medications constant during the primary endpoint measurement period. This is a patient population dealing with significant pain and the realities of life in which other issues arise. The longer the control period is set, the more patients will be deemed non-responders for taking medications unrelated to their back pain. These are the practical realities of running a clinical trial. So now let's look at the clinical results beyond 120 days. These are the results that are most important to practicing physicians. The proportion of patients reporting clinically relevant improvements continue to grow beyond the 120-day assessment through 1 year for both the treatment group and the control group after the control group having their devices turned to therapeutic levels of stimulation. At the time we filed the PMA, 160 patients had completed the 1 year assessment visit, consisting of 80 in each group. In this population, all efficacy outcomes for the treatment group and for the control group post-crossover, which we just call the crossover group, all of them progressively improved through the 1 year assessment visit, including all of the measures I just mentioned. This is consistent with the rehabilitative nature of the therapy. To make this clear, let me share a few important results from these patients, reflecting 1 year of therapy for the treatment group and 8 months of therapy for the crossover group. 66% of the combined patients had a VAS reduction of at least 30% at 1 year. Importantly, 64% of the combined patients had a VAS reduction of at least 50% at 1 year. A remitter rate of 53%, meaning 53% of patients had back pain resolved based on reporting a low back pain VAS of 2.5 or less. 71% of the combined patients had an ODI reduction of at least 15 points. And the average ODI reduction across the combined groups was 20.5 points. Taking these patients on average from a baseline ODI of approximately 40, which is the border of severe disability, to an average ODI at 1 year below 20, which is minimal disability. 74% of the combined patients categorized their own level of improvement as better or much better at 1 year, and 75% of the combined patients had their improvement rated by their doctor as much better. These are significant improvements for this very difficult to treat patient population. These data are preliminary and subject to change as additional subjects reach the 1 year assessment point, obviously, but these are very high response rates that we believe further validate the therapy, particularly taking into account that this patient population has been suffering from chronic low back pain for 14 years on average, and the many other therapies they've tried have not offered improvement over the long term. And when you ask the patients how they felt about this therapy, the additional data point that I'm going to share becomes very clear in that 79% of the combined patients rated their total satisfaction with the therapy as definitely satisfied at 1 year. So the study also assessed patients' level of pain medication usage, including opioids, after the 120-day point, which was the time when the protocol permitted patients to adjust their own medication usage. Despite the fact that the study was not designed for the purpose of reducing opioid use, 49% of the 61 patients who were on opioids at baseline had either discontinued or decreased their use of opioids at the 1 year time point. Notably, patients who decreased or discontinued opioids had similar efficacy results as the overall population. These results are subject to change, of course, as the remaining patients reach the 1 year assessment. With respect to safety, no clinically relevant lead migration was observed, and the incidence and type of adverse events, including serious adverse events, compares favorably to that of spinal cord stimulator devices with no unanticipated adverse events related to the device, procedure, or stimulation. We look forward to discussing the PMA and our overall data package with the FDA as part of the review process. As I mentioned, assuming the FDA accepts the submission for filing in October, we expect a decision around the end of 2020. Now, on the regulatory topic, a quick note regarding the Australian regulatory process. We submitted the dossier for TGA review and approval this summer. As REACTIVATE is a novel treatment, we expect the Australian TGA to engage an advisory panel to assist with the assessment. In addition, once regulatory approval is received, we will then require a separate approval for reimbursement. Our expected time frame for both approvals is late 2020. Turning now to our efforts in Germany. First, it's important to understand our overarching commercial objectives in Germany. The nature of the German healthcare system does not make it ideal for rapid uptake of a new therapy. This is largely because it consists primarily of private purchasing groups that are highly incentivized to drive down costs. However, the system has highly trained physicians, clear diagnostic protocols, and a system where potential REACTIVATE patients have mostly all undergone physical therapy and medication management already. These characteristics make Germany a strong market for initial introduction of REACTIVATE and a market where we can validate the lessons we've learned in our clinical studies to date regarding patient selection, patient management, and training of physicians and their staff. Success in Germany, although defined in terms of accounts doing repeat procedures rather than sheer volume of procedures or absolute revenue, will pave the way for expansion into other core markets of the UK, Australia, and the US. So how are we doing in Germany? We currently have a small team of 5 people that's focused on building a limited number of high volume REACTIVATE practices that allow us to gather associated clinical data and refine our selection techniques. Despite our commercial transitions, we were able to approximately double our sales revenue from 2017 to 2018, and our revenue from the first half of 2019 is almost at the level of our full 2018 revenue. We also believe that given the restorative nature of the product, physicians' impressions of the product will become increasingly favorable as they gain clinical experience that correlates to our clinical results. We've been primarily focused on the German market. In addition, we've now seen our first commercial cases in the UK and Ireland, although expansion in those markets will be relatively slow until next year as we work through the reimbursement processes. In short, we're making good progress with our commercial validation efforts. With that, I'll now turn the call over to Matt for a brief summary of our financial results for the first half of 2019 and a summary of our financing activities. Matt?
Thanks, Jason. Our most important financial activities since the beginning of 2019 have been related to ensuring that the business has sufficient cash resources to pursue our clinical, regulatory, and commercial objectives. In July, we completed the final steps of our financing plan by raising gross proceeds of 16.9 million euros, or approximately 18.9 million US dollars, through an equity offering in which we issued 4.6 million new ordinary shares at a purchase price of 3 euros per share, together with a drawdown of 3 million euros in additional debt from our existing lender. That followed the restructuring of our debt facility, which we completed in April. In exchange for issuing to the lender a warrant to purchase 1.5 million ordinary shares for a per-share purchase price of 6 euros, the debt was restructured to amend the repayment schedule so that no principal or interest repayment occurs until 2021, reduce the interest rate and eliminate the repayment fee, make available to us the new tranche of 3 million euros, conditioned upon our equity financing, and make the debt convertible into ordinary shares at 8 euros per share if we receive FDA approval for Reactivate or in certain other circumstances. All of these transactions together resulted in approximately $28 million in cash runway extension for the company. We will deploy our resources carefully over the remainder of 2019 and 2020 as we prioritize the creation of value through commercial validation activities in Europe and regulatory approval activities in the U.S. and Australia. Turning now briefly to our financial results for the first half of 2019, revenue during the period was $0.6 million, compared to revenue for the first half of 2018 of $0.36 million. Operating expenses for the first half of 2019 were $9.5 million versus $15.8 million for the first half of 2018. The decrease was driven primarily by reduced costs relating to activities for the Reactivate-B clinical trial following the completion of all implants, as well as a decrease in payroll-related costs following a reduction in headcount in 2019. Our cash on hand at June 30, 2019 was $5.8 million, compared to $29.7 million at December 31, 2018. Cash on hand at July 31, 2019, after our financing transactions, was $23.5 million. With that, I will turn the call back to Jason.
Good deal. Thanks, Matt. The market potential for Reactivate is significant, and we believe the data from our pivotal clinical trial is compelling. It will help drive commercial adoption in Europe and then support ultimate FDA approval. Thanks for your time. Now we're happy to take your questions. Operator, can you open it up for questions, please?
Thank you. If you do wish to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad. If you wish to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing 02 to cancel. Our first question comes from the line of Andrew Young from Davy. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good afternoon. I've got a couple of questions. I'll start off with my first one to do with the PMA submission. Is it fair to say that the pre-specified analyses are the most compelling data in the submission? And typically, do these types of analyses resonate with regulators? Have they been considered previously in file submissions? And secondly, with respect to the approval decision expected end of 2020, could that decision come earlier in the year? Is there any scenario where that might happen? Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for the questions, Andrew. So first on the data, the way to think of this is if you're a practicing physician who treats these patients, the most compelling data in our PMA is the one-year data, because you're most concerned about your patient's long-term outcomes. So you're looking at the one-year data. You want to know, what are the odds my patient benefits significantly from this therapy at a year? I think it's from a practical physician perspective. If you look at it and say, what is FDA most concerned about, I think the pre-specified endpoints that you describe are very important to FDA, because those are within the confines of how the study was set up. And so having FDA understand all of the data at that primary endpoint of 120 days is very important. And the fact that the pre-specified endpoints were defined before the data was revealed makes those things very valuable. And so the two analyses that I described as the pre-specified endpoints will be very important with our back and forth to FDA. Hopefully, that's satisfactory to them. And then the focus becomes the longer-term data and how well the patients are doing beyond that endpoint. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's very helpful. And with respect to the approval decision.
Yep. So it could come earlier, certainly.
Mm.
Our expectation is that we will have an advisory panel with FDA, and that's a panel where FDA will bring in outside physicians, statisticians, experts, assemble a panel. And that the process of doing a panel like that adds a few months to the process. And so the timeline that we've put out as a forecast around the end of next year assumes the several-month process of assembling that panel and holding a meeting. That's the biggest time block in our forecast that could move. If we don't have an advisory panel and FDA manages this directly itself, it could come meaningfully sooner.
Okay, thank you. Got a couple of questions as well regarding your commercial strategy. With respect to Europe, how has the strategy changed there since last year? And this year, have you been able to leverage any of the Reactivate B trial data with physicians and increase the number of implants? That's my first question. And second question, how should we think of the commercial strategy in Europe over the next 2 years? Given the expected PMA decision at the end of 2020, will it be modest growth until then? And then there might be more resources there to propel activities and, again, you know, using your experience from Europe to accelerate that.
Yeah, so just to frame it, I'll take the last piece of your question first. The answer is largely yes. The way to think about it is when we are sitting on a U.S. approval and therefore have the capability of raising the resources needed to expand, we obviously will spend the resources where they're most valuable. And I think that and the U.S. approval itself will spur significant opportunities for growth in Europe. So a significant yes to that question. Now, what's changed at all? The only real change over the last year in Europe has been focusing really exclusively on accounts, hospitals, where we're confident that we can partner with a physician to do significant implants in a single account so that our limited resources can be used to follow the most number of patients the most efficiently. And so we are looking at accounts that will have the potential to do at least an implant every month on average. That will generate a data set around how we're selecting and caring for patients that is really valuable to our learnings, and it allows physicians to get up to speed, and we therefore can gather and use that clinical data as we go forward. Maybe as part of the FDA process, which would be great, maybe in publications so that we can learn more and work with more physicians, but that's been the main focus. And we have we've achieved the goals we set for ourselves in how many sites are implanting right now in Germany. We have those sites. Now they've all come on board. Now our job is to get them to the potential we believe they have of doing the implant a month. Because what typically happens is you identify a site, you introduce the therapy. This therapy is immediately understood by the doctors who see these patients. And they ultimately do their first procedure. And they do their first procedure, and then they wait, as they should. How does this patient do? How do they recover? Let me make sure I can manage them the right way. And then they start doing more implants. And that's what we see. And that's why the uptake, although physicians coming on board is rapid as we'd like, the implant volume just lags behind it. And I would expect the next 6 to 12 months to see that implant volume pick up, even in this small number of accounts. And then what do you look at, like you asked, for the next 2 years? We've just did our first commercial implants in Switzerland and the UK. And I think those are both meaningful markets. We use our lessons from Germany to get into those markets more significantly. And ultimately, this experience helps us focus and shorten the adoption cycle in the U.S. when we launch.
Okay, thank you very much. That's very helpful. With respect to, you mentioned there you did your first implant in Switzerland and the U.K. Are those reps, do you have reps in the U.K. and Switzerland as well, or is it just Germany and you? They're stationed in Germany, and then they travel around Europe. How does it work in terms of the costings there? And
yes, we do have.
You have in Europe.
Yeah, we have someone dedicated in the UK. Lucky for us, the UK has been part of our clinical studies to date, so that person has been in the UK and dedicated for several years as we've been doing. We have six accounts in the UK that are actively recruiting patients as part of clinical studies. So that's been a great transition for us as we get closer to being truly commercial, and a person similarly dedicated to Switzerland. The therapy just requires it. You need someone on the ground who can regularly visit, who can train nurses and staff, who are there for all the follow-ups as the patients come back. It's small numbers of people overall, but they're dedicated to those markets.
Okay. Thanks for that. Finally, I've got a question on financials. Maybe Matt could help. In terms of costs going forward, I know you mentioned this, but is there any significant cost to go into the business in the next 12 to 18 months before you have clarity on the PMA decision? Is the organization quite streamlined now and as streamlined as it will be?
It's quite streamlined now. You know, after we announced the initial Reactivate B data at the end of last year, we undertook a process to narrow the company's focus specifically to regulatory approval activities in the U.S. and Australia, and then continued commercial validation efforts in Europe. And so we streamlined the organization to the headcount of the organization to be aligned to those goals and then raise the money based on that plan. So, you know, the what we see from in OPEX and cash use and operations in the first half of 2019, we would expect that to be fairly constant, maybe a little bit lower going forward throughout the rest of 2019 and through 2020.
Okay. That's very helpful. Thanks, all. That's me. Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
Just as a reminder, if you do wish to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad now. As there are no further questions, I'll hand it back to the speakers.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for joining our call. We will have a busy next 6 months as we intensify our interactions with FDA and continue to make progress in commercial validation in Europe. So look forward to checking back in with everybody soon, and thanks for your time and interest in Mainstay. Take care. Bye-bye.
This now concludes our conference call. Thank you all for attending. You may now disconnect your lines.